environment isn't, you know, the preoccupation with the environment by an Aboriginal writers as one of the characteristics isn't just a leftover from or somebody's constructed idea of who we are. It is a part of our cultural consciousness in terms of our humanity and our regard for how we see our participation as a life form on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's reflected really clearly as a philosophical construct of culture, of ourselves. And the construction of that in our literatures, I think, is really an incredibly important issue in terms of looking at what is Aboriginal thought, what is Aboriginal values or ethics that arises in, and in relation to what are the themes or perspectives that come out of the literature. So one of the things that I could see there is that it can contribute to raising of consciousness to the rest of the community and liberate, you know, not only our people in terms of their understanding, their identity, their culture, and i.e. their literature, but also the liberation of the idea that, we as human beings are, you know, destructive, you know, and are sinners.
Okay. Well, we've covered that already. I came across in some discussions, I don't think it's a quote from you, but this is something I heard from people, ancestral memory, but that would bring us back to the question that we talked about before, you know, ethnicity or blood. If there's ancestral memory, it would be something that is in the blood.
Do you think there is such a thing?
Well, let me put it as a question back to you. My question always has been in relation to the way that, for instance, we perceive our Okanagan ethnicity. For us, the Okanagan ethnicity has something to do with the way that we respond to not only a certain type of climate, but the vegetation and the land itself, the way our bodies respond to it, the way our bodies respond to the food and, you know, to the sunlight, the dry air,
and so on, right?
Our bodies know this land.
Yeah.
In a way which our minds do not know. And that response can be brought forward into voice. And so when we're talking about ancestral memory, that is not something you can reproduce. And it does have something to do with the physical ethnicity of the Okanagan person, but doesn't have to do with race or blood in the sense of just because I have, you know, Okanagan blood running through my veins, that I have this ancestral memory. For me, and I talk about this in the interview with Simon, that there I feel this response as a subconscious rising and welling up inside of me that has to do with sound and has to do with rhythm and has to do with the colors of the land here, and really has a lot to do with the land. Oh, okay, go ahead. So what I'm talking about that is when I hear the songs, when I hear the sounds in our language, in particular the rhythm of the sounds of the language and the rhythm of the songs, they evoke something that is for me is a very difficult thing to explain. I can see and understand what it's about without the words. I know that that's hard to say. And what I try to do as a writer is to try to move that into words and find a way to. And I think that's where some of the poetry comes from, and some of the images and the imagery that are produced to put that into the words come from. And when I'm writing that, and that's why I said we'll talk about poetry later. When we talk about poetry, and when I'm talking about it as an Okanagan writer and as an Okanagan with ancestral memory, I'm talking about where that poetry comes from and where the language actually originates from.
Okay.
And where the sounds that make up the sounds, and in my visual arts, where the colors come from.
I think I can relate to that, because
I think anyone that has deep connection, ancestral connection to their lands, can relate to that. Even if you're far removed.
It's also the smell
and the feeling of the wind on the skin. And I think that's something that is passed on in terms of the body, because I have this notion that your body knows where its place is better than your mind does or your heart does.
I think there's medical research to support that too. Yeah. If you think of theories about what you should eat to avoid cancer, it's not eating imported health food. It's local food.
And obviously, because of your mind is a chemical, slurry. Your mind should be able to provide you with that, not only the emotional but also the rational backup, that this feels like home, this sounds like home, this the body is in a sense recognizing ancestral sounds and language and voice and land. And that's not something that we construct. That's not something that we can deliberately put in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. And I think all people probably experience that, whether they've been removed from the homeland for generations and they return to a homeland that is their ancestral homeland, that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was talking about. And I think in a lot of ways, our literatures, in terms of the poetry, and in terms of some of the, like the writing for theater performance and so on, is sourced by that and is fueled by that. So when I talk about ancestral memory, that's part of it. The other part of it has to do with ancestral memory. For instance, we do these exercises in class.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has, family. Everyone comes from family. A lot of bits and pieces come through in the actions, the gestures, the messages, the unstated things that are said by your parents and your grandparents and your aunts and uncles and so on, that make up all these little bits and pieces of something that you never experienced yourself as a person, but that come through to you, that is ancestral, and that can become almost caught and pulled together into a net to create this story. And Scott Momaday talks about that in terms of, I think, the essay, The Man Made of
Words.
And I refer to that quite a bit because he draws on that to tell the story of, say, the Way to Rainy Mountain, for instance, or The House Made at Dawn.
Yeah.
And I clicked into that and thought, all the things that, the stories that, bits and pieces of the story that I heard my grandmother, mm-hmm. Christine, that my Uncle Charlie, my Uncle Martin, mm-hmm. you know, and all these, Tommy Gregory, all these old people, I hear them talking and speaking mm-hmm. and visiting and politicking and thinking and all that, referring to people.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I see those people. I see that time and I see that place. I've never been there, you know. I know the time when there was nothing but horses and wagons, you know. I know that time almost as if I were there, and, you know. And I can conjure them up and call them up because I can hear my parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles talking about them. And the descriptions and the imagery residing in our language is so vivid that I see the pictures in. That's the other type of ancestral memory I'm talking
something
about.
Something Dan Runnels told me.
Yeah.
He said, well, in the Okanagan language, if you knew the word of a plant, even if you haven't seen the plant, but if mm-hmm. you know the word, you'll immediately recognize the plant because it's so descriptive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He actually sends his regards.
Oh, okay.
I can really, I think understand what you say, because it may also be things that, you know, I remember bits of pieces when I sat under the table and the women were sitting around sharing stories
mm-hmm.
and they thought I didn't even understand because I was so young. But
mm-hmm.
they're tidbits coming back and they're
mm-hmm.
part of my
mm-hmm.
perception of
yeah.
of the world
yeah.
and what happened to
yeah.
my family, what happened to my people.
Yeah. And you carry that with you,
yeah.
inside of you.
And the older you get,
yeah.
the more it also matures,
or
ferments
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you can do more with it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think, you know, for Aboriginal people,
mm-hmm.
those ancestral memories of that period of, you know, that period of struggle is very much one of the characteristics of our people, a period of struggle, of the early contact period. In the U.S., for instance, where there was a huge amount of violence perpetrated against Indian peoples across the country, relocating them and, you know, having wars with them, the huge amount of fear and, you know, starvation and hardships that reside in the ancestral memory. Those can be pulled forward and reliably so by those writers who have that capacity to bring all these little tiny bits of story together and create it and make it into one vessel.
Yeah.
To talk about that.
It's especially suffering.
Mm-hmm.
If I think of my
mm-hmm.
family and Ruth's family, they're also displaced
mm-hmm.
you know, at the end
mm-hmm.
of the war, and
mm-hmm.
there are all these stories of displacement, of the old place and
mm-hmm.
the new place and all that. It's there, and the
mm-hmm.
older we get, the more we realize,
mm-hmm.
although we weren't part of it, my mother was
mm-hmm.
pregnant with me, Ruth was born later, but it's there, it shapes
yeah.
our experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not so much that it has to do with blood,
mm-hmm.
but it, you know, in a way it has to do with cultural
yeah.
Memory. Transgenerational, that's not something that can be constructed or something
no.
that can be created because you're a creative writer.
Mm.
You know, I challenge any writer that says that.
Good. Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you for that.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes, when I try to describe your work and what you do,
mm-hmm.
use the term, but I always say maybe in a way a cultural nationalist. Just sort of what I know about cultural nationalism, the little I know, I might describe you as one.
Sure.
You?
Yeah. Yeah. If I'm following your
mm-hmm.
definition,
mm-hmm.
That has been a concern of mine intellectually.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean in terms of nation-state.
No, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm, and that's why I said that
mm-hmm.
that has been a concern of mine
mm-hmm.
intellectually. You know, and to some extent I have you know, Paul picked on the, you know, on the political, mm-hmm. legal defense of mm-hmm. the Okanagan Nation's mm-hmm. rights mm-hmm. and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. But what I'm more concerned with is that, for me, and the position that I come from mm-hmm. is that diversity of culture is something that is really essential in terms of the health of humanity. And I think, and that's, you know, globally, and
yeah.
I think that in a large way, for me, what our peoples have encountered as a result of colonialism and fascism, you know, I can't describe it any other way, because what was done to our people in this country is fascist. We're not allowed to be who we are. We're not allowed to practice and live our economy and our, you know, political structure. What's even more fascist about it is we're not allowed to speak our languages. We're not allowed, in a sense, to be Okanagan, in the pure sense of being Okanagan. We have to reconfigure ourselves so that we're, you know, Canadian,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, whatever that might
yeah.
be. And so that's one aspect of it, but for me the more focus, my focus has been on understanding what the Okanagan culture is, what the worldview is, what the philosophy is, what our understanding of, for instance, our understanding of our relationship to other living beings,
mm-hmm.
our relationship
mm-hmm.
to the land. What our practices in terms of our societal culture
mm-hmm.
Is gives me an understanding that there's good reason for me to believe that there's a better way of doing things than I see going on out there. And that doesn't mean that, you know, that I want to be Okanagan just because I'm Okanagan. What I see is that there's some things about being Canadian, there's some things about being part of the Western market economy and, you know, the competition of you know, for, you know, your survival that isn't healthy for any human being. And it isn't healthy for family systems, it isn't healthy for individuals, and it isn't healthy for anybody in the community. It isn't healthy for the living things on the land. It isn't healthy for the water. It isn't definitely not healthy for the climate. You know,
there's
so
no future.
There's no future in that. And so one of the things that I do see is that there are some better ways of approaching things. There are some better baseline values that reside in my
mm-hmm.
culture
mm-hmm.
That make more sense to me, and that I not only want to be able to practice and live
mm-hmm.
and, you know, pass on to my children and grandchildren, but I want to be able to advocate it. I want to be able to share it, you know, with others, and
mm-hmm.
and let others make up their minds, you know. And I and as important, when I say the intellectual
mm-hmm.
part of me says that intellectually I can see that there's a need for the Okanagan
mm-hmm.
thought and the Okanagan practice of
mm-hmm.
life and lifeway as Ojibwe or
mm-hmm.
Inuit, because there's a number of yeah. things in those indigenous cultures that survived and is the reason we survived, by
mm-hmm.
the way, that are critically important for others to be able to appreciate, learn from, and incorporate in their own ways,
mm-hmm.
in their own cultures. Not the same way, but in their own ways. And I think that literature and writing and the specific characteristics of our literature provide a way to do that, provide a way for that to happen. So from my point of view, our literatures are increasingly important and incredibly important in that process of liberating, you know, liberation of ourselves as human beings. And that's what literature
yeah.
is and does, I think.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, we talked about language to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, the forces you were talking about are the forces that threaten our survival, so mm-hmm. to speak. You're also involved in discussions about or against globalization. Somewhere I also found something where you specifically mentioned, I think, class. You know how people who are disenfranchised, who are exploited, who are marginalized, also need to come together,
mm-hmm.
and that it's not that it's also an economic system,
uh-huh.
capitalism,
mm-hmm.
that operates,
mm-hmm.
and that is lethal to
mm-hmm.
survival,
mm-hmm.
because it's based on self-interest, to
mm-hmm.
put in acceptably. I once
mm-hmm.
used greed, and a friend of mine who's a philosopher, he said, we don't talk about the cardinal sins anymore. Don't call it greed, it's interest.
Well, I just attended this really interesting conference
mm-hmm.
That was organized by a woman by the name of Genevieve Vaughn,
mm-hmm.
and whose organization, she heads up an organization called the Gift Economy.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to share some thoughts at that conference, as well as contribute,
mm-hmm.
you know, to
mm-hmm.
some of the dialogue that was going on. One of the ideas of that organization is that there's a better economic system in terms of gift exchange, gift giving, that needs to be thought about and put into place than competition or competitive
yeah.
economy, competing economies,
yeah.
That, and there's some rational reasons why we need to rethink how that gift economy should be structured intelligently into, you know, into our political systems and our social systems and so on. And so one of the things that they were talking about is that the competing economies create fear, the competing economies create poverty, and the immense amount of waste, the immense amount of stockpiling and hoarding and,
yeah.
In order for profit,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
profit
yeah.
Motive. So all of those issues, when you look at indigenous communities, for instance, that had gift economy systems, one of the things that you alleviate right away is the amount of waste because
yeah.
because of the way gifts are circulated and exchanged. And one of the things you immediately dispense with is the structuring of who has more and who has less. The idea of a gift economy is that if you have more than, you know, there's something wrong with you
yeah,
in
yeah,
that economy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that you're social aberrant if you have more.
Yeah.
That perspective and attitude still exists in my community. You're suspect and you're suspicious and you're not to be trusted if you have more.
That's very much, I think, was the case, and that fell by the wayside, but a
mm-hmm.
lot of that was actually, I think, learned by people under socialism.
Mm-hmm.
I live in
mm-hmm.
East Germany now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that it didn't also result in jealousy,
yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
people were forced almost
yeah.
to sort of be
yeah.
on the same, usually low level.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of that, you know, not being tied to private property
yeah.
and authority
yeah.
was something they learned, and
yeah.
sharing
yeah.
it can be learned.
It
and
can.
I think
yeah.
I'm not advocating socialism the way it existed, but I still
no.
think that a lot of what socialism or a socialist, even Marxist analysis of capitalism does is absolutely true.
I don't see that
socialism as it was implemented worked. It did not. But
So part of the idea of creating a program here at an Alkin Center, which now we're talking about the future, is the idea of the indigenous knowledge systems and the underpinnings that the arts create in that, in a contemporary sense, being an essential part of and being an essential part of the production of people who are skilled and people who are artists and writers and performers and so on, that are providing that perspective with not only with dignity but also with assurance back into their own communities and into the wider, you know, into the wider community. I think the more people that are given the opportunity to liberate their voice and given the opportunity to do serious artistic inquiry as a part of their learning process about writing and about, you know, visual arts or music or performance in relation to what is indigenous thought, what is indigenous practice and perspective, and what is its you know, importance, and what are the principles that we need to equip our students with and equip ourselves with when we go back into, you know, our communities or into, you know, the wider community. Do we know how to speak about these things? Do we know how to provide critical analysis? Do we know how to put into practice in our communities a better way of doing things by speaking about those better ways, by reflecting those better ways, by practicing those better ways? So that's a part of what, in terms of an outcome, and part of what, you know, in terms of what I do. It's a broader reason than literature itself, arts itself. So in terms of the future, what I do see is that there will, in the next 25 years, be a blossoming, I think, and a change in terms of the literatures, reflecting more clearly the indigenous voice, especially if the original literatures are feeling that, in terms of contemporary works, right? And the same thing I would say with visual arts. And and I think in a lot of ways, new material is needed out there in terms of the, our literature and our arts for our young people to mediate that problem that's occurring in our younger generations in terms of the identity, the cultural identity crisis that they go through. And also the poisoned, I guess you could say, decadence of Western society's offerings of culture, pop culture, drug culture, you know, and skinhead culture, and, you know, and so on, that our young people get sucked up into, you know, so that there's this viable, healthy alternative that does, that is a source, you know, of inspiration and pride and enlightenment and uplifting, and contributes, you know, to recovery and health of our communities. So those aspects are always, you know, at the bottom. I think, from my point of view, the arts are the place that that best can take root and take hold. The Band-Aid solutions, you know, they're there and they're people are making money out of them.
Absolutely.
You know, but I think the longer term solutions come from our literatures and our arts and the practice of equipping our people with how to incorporate that as an essential element of their life's practice, and their life way, and their culture, and their community.
When we talked 15 years ago, you said, I think I recall, that when with Theta's books and the Naukin writing school, you said, we've got to show that we do everything ourselves, we can do it, and even if it takes us 20 years,
mm-hmm.
we will produce writers, we will produce
mm-hmm.
our own books and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons why I also used the term cultural nationalism.
Yeah.
But I didn't... And for, I think, 14 issues or 13 issues, gatherings was all Aboriginal. And in the 14th issue, you had two non-Aboriginals contributing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the near future, there'll probably be a collaborative volume with a co-editor or with contributions 50-50 from Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal
mm-hmm.
people.
Exactly.
Is that a change in shift, or is that... well, maybe you can comment on that.
Well, yeah, definitely is it,
mm-hmm.
you know, a shift in the transformation
mm-hmm.
In terms of what originally
mm-hmm.
the Gatherings Journal is about. Gatherings was a support journal to... be able to give a vehicle to emergent writers and writers that were, you know, having hard time getting their stuff, you know, accepted
mm-hmm.
Into some of the review journals and
yeah.
scholarly reviews that are talking literary
mm-hmm.
reviews
yeah. Yeah.
Because of the lack of understanding about some of the characteristics
mm-hmm.
of Aboriginal writing or some of the purposes of Aboriginal writing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons we decided to create a journal was
mm-hmm.
to be able to select a voice that was current, that you know, was coming out,
mm-hmm.
And select a voice of those writers that were, you know, that we're publishing, but publishing slowly.
Yeah.
And select also writings of prominent Aboriginal mm-hmm. writers to include. So one of the reasons and one of the purposes was to give a vehicle to those writers on a yearly, sort of like every year people look forward to going to this gathering at Welpert or Nispelum, because then they can touch base and
mm-hmm.
talk to people
mm-hmm.
and hear other people
mm-hmm.
that they haven't seen for a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you do that at various gatherings, right? And so we thought of this journal as being something like that, a place where the voices
mm-hmm.
could gather in the one volume. People who have been longtime writers, people who are,
mm-hmm.
you know, writing, you know, a little bit known but not very well known, and then
mm-hmm.
virtually unknown writers. And we thought, you know, a good idea would be to provide different
yeah.
Themes, you know, every year, so that the voices could gather around these themes
mm-hmm.
and we could hear a lot of different ideas
mm-hmm.
and thoughts and writing.
Analcan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's what Analcan, the word it means itself,
yeah.
to
yeah.
be able to do that. So we thought this volume was good. Well, in terms of the transition, we have moved into a transition
mm-hmm.
in terms of what we do as an Elkin, and also we have moved into a transition in terms of literature, Aboriginal literatures and Indigenous
mm-hmm.
literatures. There isn't the there's more of a need now that we can see for the coming together of voices to talk to each other about the academics of Aboriginal writing and the positioning of it, both from the academics' view and from
mm-hmm.
the Aboriginal people's view, along with writing about
mm-hmm.
it. And so we're looking at that kind of journal now, where
mm-hmm.
we're possibly collaborating with a number of, you know, collaboration with a non-native like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we want to invite you to be the co-editor with someone to pull this next journal together. Mm-hmm. Not the one we're doing right now.
No.
The one we're doing right now, of course, is focused on Aboriginal language, original literatures.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be also
yeah.
a transition as well, is that we're looking at the use of first language contributions in a bilingual form, and you know, and I think that's really exciting, and I think that's going to be kind of the launch of a number of different directions we can go with that. We can either regionalize chapters or you know, whatever, but this first one, you know, we're going to launch this year. The other one, the collaboration that we're talking about, is also, in my mind, it creates another direction we can go. So that, I think, is really indicative to me that we're maturing in terms of,
That's what I was thinking too. You need to have a solid ground and say, okay, here I stand, this is defined, now we can open ourselves and say, okay, let's... Let's dialogue with them. Let's okay.
Without defensiveness or hostility or you know, the vast amount
without
of
fear.
Misunderstanding. Fear, and also without some of the, you know, processes that were silencing us in place. Now there's a listening ear, and there's willingness, you know, on both sides to hear each other out. And you know, I think that very much is the climate, and is a better climate for our literatures today.
Famous last words.
Okay. well, I'm really looking forward to this collaboration, but I'm also really looking forward to the idea of Aboriginal written literatures and how that might be thought about in countries like Germany and other countries like that. I think it'd be a very exciting message to send out to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
That hasn't, that window hasn't been there.
But there is much more interest out in the world than I think a lot of Aboriginal people know.
Oh yes,
A lot of Aboriginals know more about it, and they also think about it in terms of marketing venues, which are there, which is fine. But I was amazed in India, you know, how many scholars there were who were really knowledgeable.
Oh,
I read a lot. And there was also an understanding, partly because of the shared colonial past of being part of the, having been part of the British Empire. So it's really...
But other countries too.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
That, for instance, Japan was organizing, the University of Tokyo was organizing a literature's conference, minorities literatures conference, and I was invited to, you know, to make a presentation and to speak there. I've been invited to India and to Pakistan, and I've been invited to Korea. That this World Women's Literature Center in Korea has invited me to come at some point. I haven't, you know, agreed to come, but you know, in Italy and Spain and other countries like that, I think have taken a real interest in Aboriginal writing and Aboriginal literatures, and I think that can even be more exciting if these original voice literatures get out there.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that they wanna that they wanna hear and, and you know, be exposed to. So I'm very excited about that.
Another thing, you can switch that off or so, but I was wondering, you've done all this work, you've published novels, you've published poetry, you speak in all countries of the world, you've got a name as an international activist on behalf of, say, survival and the earth. So you really have an international name, and I know that you're looking into possibilities for more sort of academic accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
Why that? I think you've got an honorary doctorate already, right?
Oh, yeah. It's mm-hmm. not so much the accreditation, it's the reason for me to do the work that I want to do.
Uh-huh, okay.
And so, you know, and that's basically what I said to people mm-hmm. at UBC that I was talking mm-hmm. to, is that I've been doing a lot of management and administrative mm-hmm. work to mm-hmm. put these programs into place and, you know, get them up and mm-hmm. running. And I've been doing some writing on my own, but I haven't been spending a lot of time as a scholar mm-hmm. Doing some research and thinking
and
dialoguing with other scholars, and I really need that
yeah,
at this
okay.
point in my life.
And that would almost give mm-hmm. like a framework within which you could do that, and also would allow you to yourself to do
yeah,
that. Say,
exactly.
I'm working on my thesis now. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And also the scholarly community
mm-hmm.
is something
mm-hmm.
that I'm needing to I reached a plateau in my life,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that I need to do. And I feel that I need to do to move my own writing
mm-hmm.
and my own thinking
mm-hmm.
into another place.
Mm-hmm.
And so the inquiry approach to me is something that is a necessary part for me in anything new things that I do. So that's where I see it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where
okay.
I see it moving towards.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's not so much, you know, the PhD or
mm-hmm.
the credentialing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
any of that part,
yeah.
So I can take that or leave.
yeah.
But I want it to be in a
yeah.
literary
yeah.
area,
yeah.
you know, which, you know, I talked
yeah.
with you about it. I don't see it, you know, if it was a PhD that I needed,
yeah.
I can get one in education, you
yeah.
know, within the next year,
yeah.
or, you know, or some other
yeah.
area.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not the reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Algo más?
Exacto.